The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
I'm Grace Bonney of After the Jump, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil's grooving them rhythm and blues that Sam is gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. It's finally hitting us. It was a terrible winter this year, and it lasted for what seemed like an eternity, but now we're finally moving in the spring, and I can't think of a better beverage to have, other than beer, of course, in this kind of weather, than a good old gin and tonic. And to speak with me today on the show, I have my good buddy, Stephen D'Angelo, from Green Hook Ginsmiths. It's a fairly new gin company in New York City, and Brooklyn specifically, that has been really spreading like wildfire. How long ago did you start, Stephen? First of all, welcome to the show.
Thank you. We started in, we actually launched, our first bottle was sold in February 2012. We were planning it for, you know, a few years prior to that, but that was actually when we sold our first bottles, was in February 12th. So it's been, you know, not quite 2.5 years. It's been about 2.25 years, I guess.
It's crazy, man.
It's kind of fast.
I feel like everywhere I go, there's a bottle on the bar, and that's it's very, very impressive, man.
Thank you. Well, yeah. We've had a lot of support in New York. Obviously, it's a great market to be building a brand. You know, to be your home market, because there's obviously a lot of potential out there. Yeah. You know?
I always say this ain't a vacation town, man.
No,
you're here to like work your ass off.
And, yeah, absolutely.
You know, you've definitely been doing that.
Yeah, it's been an interesting ride. I mean, it doesn't even seem like it's been that long, actually. I mean, I'm just thinking back at actually probably the first time I came into Prime Meats. It doesn't seem like it's well over 2 years ago at this point, you know.
No, not at all. Yeah, man. It's pretty crazy. It's been highly successful, man. It's crazy.
Thank you.
Yeah. So I mean, speaking of hard work, I mean, like, dude, it takes a lot to build a distillery, and like, It's something that a lot of people would like not really go for, man. So like, what was the inspiration for getting into that?
Yeah, well, actually, I told somebody the other day, if I knew then what I know now, I don't know if I'd be.
Yeah, exactly. Man.
Building a distillery is tough, especially in New York, though, because you got, you know, rightfully so, tons of regulation. I mean, you got regulations not only in the federal level, but the state level, but you also here have the, the local level. You got the building department, fire department. You got a lot of obstacles to be dealing with. So, I mean, from inception, just like sort of coming up with the idea to the time that we actually sold our first bottle, we're pretty close to 3 years, actually.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's building the, there's so many things that go into. You know,
a lot of red tape.
A lot of red tape, yeah. And then you just open your doors. That doesn't mean you sold the bottle yet at that point.
Yeah, totally. It's a high-risk situation,
It's definitely high-risk, yeah. Yeah, hopefully high-reward as well, but that takes time, you know.
Yeah. I mean, and actually, speaking of high-risk and high-reward, I mean, you kind of came from that world, right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, after I graduated school, I went to work in the markets. I was an interdealer broker in the money markets, capital markets. We did interest rates, money market products, stuff like that. So after, after Lehman Brothers went down and that was no longer a fun career to be in, I was still in my late 20s and I wasn't really obviously looking at packing it in or anything, but I was started working on this business plan, a few business plans, but this one was obviously really interesting. There was a lot of stuff going on, like the guys upstate, Tuttletown, they were sort of just getting on, just starting to hit their stride, and as I started sort of, you know, working on this plan, I became obsessed with it, of course, you know, which you have to be to get a business like this up and running. But yeah, it's been, it's been round the clock. 24/7, obviously, it's the only way to do it.
Yeah, man. No sleep till Brooklyn.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we, but it's an interesting landscape of what's going on now. And, I think there's something like maybe close to 40 distilleries in the state now, I think. Mm-hmm. Maybe even more than that. But I'm biased, but I tend to think that the ones locally are, out of all the distilleries coming up around the country, are really doing some great things.
Well, I think a lot of the distilleries that are in New York and around here, I think they're more like classically minded. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's not a lot of like bullshit products coming out, like, you know, your like lemon cookie cream liqueurs and like stuff like that. It's all like, you know, even the liqueurs that are coming out of Brooklyn, like Sorrel and like Cacao Prieto and things like that, they're like really remarkable product.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons is you wouldn't be able to sell crap in this market is the biggest reason why.
They see right through it.
Yeah. You're not going to, you know, people in this market aren't just going to buy some crap because it's made in Brooklyn. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They might do it once, but they're not going to do it over the long term.
And like, yeah, I mean, there's really no point. Like, I mean, like, even like there's a lot of distilleries like upstate and people making like, I was at the Sheep and Wool Festival like last year, and there are all these like artisanal like liqueurs, like fruit liqueurs. It's because they have those fruits on their property, and they're like, dude, let's do something with this.
Yeah.
You know, which is really the whole like spirit, if you will, of distillation.
Absolutely.
It's like, let's save this product before it spoils. That's how we started, you know, making these spirits in the first place.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really cool to like keep it like super local like that. You know, like you mentioned Tuttletown, and they like, they're making the vodka with like the apples from like their orchard that's like on their property. You know, it's really cool. Like, I think
the same thing happens in you know, in Europe. A lot of these farmers, like in Germany, with the eaux de vie and everything. Yeah. That's just, you know, what they sort of had to do.
Of course,
back in the day, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, and you know, we drink a lot of gin, so you're like, you know, I better make some gin.
Speaking of,
So I mean, I feel like, like you said, hitting the stride, there is, were you actually, how did you get into gin? Were you like a cocktail person, or did you just like drinking gin and tonics?
I was always a gin and tonic, gin and tonics and martinis, actually. Even, you know, when I was drinking gin, it was sort of like an old man's drink, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I always drank gin and tonic, Tanqueray tonic specifically, and I drank Beefeater martinis. I always loved gin, so that was sort of the reason I'm making gin, is because that's always what I love to drink more than anything else.
You're going to get high on your own supply.
Yeah,
man.
Exactly. It's not, you know, it's not an, right now, I guess it's sort of like the easiest sell would be whiskey, because people are going nuts for whiskey right now.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy the way that markets, we've been talking about on the show a little bit lately, about how the whiskey market's been, specifically the American whiskey market, has just been like out of control.
Yeah, there's no signs of slowing down either.
Yeah.
Gin's a little bit more of a, it's a tougher category. It's a tougher sale, but you know, you find the right niche. Like with our product, I think the one thing about gin that people don't realize is gin is not gin. I mean, you could have 20 well-made gins side by side, and they might all taste different.
Well, I think that's true of any category. I mean, like, think about, I mean, rum is probably the one that changes the most from terroir, location, you know, like the different cane, you know, or molasses, the way it's processed, like the way it's aged, you know, like rum is not just rum, you know.
Rum's a wide category, but there's much more, I would say, the gin, you know, category is broader. You're going to have more difference in taste of gin, even dry gins, than bourbons, for example.
Yeah. I mean, because there's no real, like, rule with gin. It's like it has to have juniper.
Yeah.
And then anything else goes.
And that's, yeah, exactly.
But that's what's really cool about it, you know? You've got a tasty platform, like a nice, like, blank canvas,
exactly.
Except, well, a juniper-colored canvas that you get to paint on, you know?
Yeah, that's got to be the backbone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, especially, you know, since we've started, you know, 10 years ago or however long ago, you know, the cocktail renaissance of, you know, the 2000s, it's really interesting to see how gin has become more of a part. Like, not even just the gin tonic, like, just the classic martini, and, like, seeing how people actually respect it in a different way than they were, like, when all these martini bars were popping up in the 90s, and it was, like, anything that was in a V-shaped glass was called a martini.
Yeah, yeah.
And now we're back to, like, all right, let's talk about this gin.
Yeah.
And let's talk about this vermouth, you know?
Yeah, and we're probably just getting started, actually, if you think about it. You know?
Yeah.
We're sort of in a bubble here when you think about New York, but it's around the country. I think we're just getting started with, you know, everything coming back, cocktails, gin cocktails specifically.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I was actually going back to what I was saying about seeing your stuff everywhere. I was in D.C. like a month ago, and I was like, God damn it, Stevens everywhere down here, too. It was amazing, man. And that's some tough competition, because you've got Green Hat, which is like the local hero.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so so it was pretty crazy, man, to see it like everywhere.
Yeah.
It was awesome, so congrats on that.
Thanks.
So as far as like martinis go, how do you like to make a martini for yourself?
I tend to like it like 2-1 or 3-1. You know, I'm not not super dry. Maybe a dash of orange bitters. I've been using the you know, the Dolan dry. I just like a sort of like a European style vermouth. I like a lot of the new American vermouths that are coming out, but I don't find them really suitable for a martini. You know, I drink it more like on the rocks.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, to drink it like more like traditional style.
How
like,
they drink it? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
yeah.
They're, yeah, because there are a lot of them that are just like super, like esoteric and like kind of experimental. You
kind of in your face, you know, where like a martini, you want something just a little bit more, a little more subtle. I guess is probably the word
you,
I'm looking for.
Yeah, you want it to be a little the vermouth to be a little bit more subtle, but you also want it to like you want it to participate. But you don't want it to take over the party.
Yeah, absolutely. You sort of want to have to think about what you taste in there, too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Rather than it hitting you in the face. But I don't really drink that many martinis. I'm really much more of a, as you know, gin and tonic.
Yeah, totally, man. You know, honestly, like, I was the same way. Like, when I started drinking gin and tonics, I was a Tanqueray tonic guy.
Yeah.
And, I mean, honestly, like, I'm probably going to get some hate mail for this, but... I have just like a soft spot for like Schweppes.
Really?
You know? Okay. I mean, I typically have like Fever Tree or like I'll make a tonic syrup. But man, sometimes like when I'm just sitting on my porch drinking a gin and tonic,
Schweppes.
Big old splash of Schweppes on top of a little gin, you know, and then just like
last year, in the New York Times, I think it was from Frank Cisneros and Eric Asimov and somebody else, they did like a tasting of the of tonics, and it was like a blind test, taste test, and I think Schweppes came out number one and Fever Tree finished last. And I was talking to Frankie, you know, I don't know, a couple months later, and he was explaining to me that a lot of times you like what you like better, what's familiar to you.
Sure.
You know, I mean, what I'm that's, saying?
Absolutely.
So it didn't necessarily mean that Schweppes was the best tonic that was tasted, but it was, I guess, because it was familiar, you know, it gets higher ratings because of that.
Yeah, that, but also, like, I like, man, I'm a huge seltzer drinker. Like, I mean, I go through a cartridge for my SodaStream machine, like, once a month, man. I just blast through it.
Yeah.
So I like that bigger, like, fizzier bubble.
Less of, like, the champagne quality.
Yeah. I mean, there's a place for it, but also it's dependent on like who's making the drink, you know. There's so many elements. Like you can't just like dump like Q tonic over ice, you know, because it'll kill it.
Yeah,
you have to like pour it delicately, like over the back of a spoon down the side, and then it's a beautiful, elegant gin and tonic.
Yeah, you can totally screw up a gin and tonic by who's serving it. By you know, not just the wrong tonic, but the wrong proportions of gin to tonic.
Well, I mean, honestly, dude, I like mine, like I always do, like, 1-7, you know?
Really? Interesting.
I go, like, really light on the gin and pretty heavy on the tonic, because that's, I feel like, you know, I want to have multiples, you know? I don't want to get wasted. I want to sit around and hang out and drink them, you know?
I was at this place on Chamber Street called Racine's, which is actually a wine bar. It's fairly new. It just opened up a couple months ago, and I ordered a Green Hook and tonic, and I see the way the guy is pouring it. It's cracking the ice, and he's, you know, he's zesting the lemon into it. And then he takes a bar spoon and he pours Fever Tree tonic down the bar spoon into a wine glass. And I said, "Where are you from?" And he said, "Basque country." I knew it. I knew the guy was Spanish, you know.
Dude, yeah.
They're serious about it.
The gin and tonics in Spain, it's just like, that's a huge, huge market. Yeah. Like, that's like their drink. But it's, you know, just in the same way that in the United States, where we take the martini and mess around with it and experiment and change it up, they are really hardcore about their gin and tonics.
Yeah. I think one of the reasons it's the gin and tonics getting so popular in Europe, because it's not just in Spain. I mean, it's in Italy, it's getting big. Of course, it's always been big in England. But the Swiss couple I met at a tasting the other night, they were telling me how big it's getting. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that over there, they tend to have drinks when they're eating something. Whereas here, we just drink all the time, you know?
Yeah.
But gin and tonic is really one of the few cocktails, for lack of a better term, that really does pair well with all food because it's dry, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
It does.
And I think there's a lot of room to play with. There's, I'm trying to remember this guy's name. But he runs a bunch of bars in D.C., and one of them is Estadio. And
I got my gin there.
Yeah, they do. I mean, I had your gin and gin and tonic there.
Nice.
They have... It's just some of the best gin and tonics.
Did you have the one with the orange and the thyme there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good, right?
It's so good.
Yeah.
So good. But it's like, I always say that a gin and tonic should never be just gin and tonic. And I'm so glad to see that, you know, bars are doing that and you're experimenting and like really like advancing what a gin and tonic can be.
Yeah.
And even like Gin Palace, you know, they have their like tap system with gin and tonics on it, but they also have like, usually they'll have like three different seasonal gin and tonics. You know?
Yeah. I, at the Manhattan Cocktail Classic, we just did something simple. We did the Green Point Spritz, which is just 3-to-1 of Green Hook American Dry, Aperol, and Fever Tree Tonic with an orange slice.
I had that at the edible book.
It's refreshing, right? It's
like, the edible, dude.
It's still better, you know?
It's so good. Yeah, you know, honestly, our director of operations for Primeats and Frankie's, that's like, that's his like morning bracer.
Oh, is it really? Yeah.
He nice. Totally does that. I mean, he throws a little Prosecco in there too, I think.
All right.
But
it up a notch.
Yeah. But yeah, that's awesome. It's such a good combo. I mean, like, you've got the, it's almost like that's such a good way to do a gin and tonic when you're, especially like at an event and you don't have like the full bar, and it's you've got all those flavors that you want in it, you know?
Sure.
It's awesome. Man.
I drink a lot of the Fever Tree Bitter Lemon too, which I think is totally underappreciated.
Super British, man.
Yeah, it goes great with gin. It goes great with my Beach Plum Gin too, which is sort of like our version of a slow gin.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to see that around at a lot, at more bars, you know, because I think it really, gin with bitter lemon, is just a great drink.
I might see if they have it here at Roberta's so we can have some.
Yeah, nice. I'll take one.
Yeah. Well, let's take a quick break, and then when we get back, we'll continue speaking with Stephen D'Angelo from Green Hook Ginsmiths. Back in a moment.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
And we are back. You're listening to The Speakeasy. And in the studio today, I got my buddy Steven from Green Hook Ginsmiths. We were just talking about the progression of the market with gin and with cocktails like the martini, but specifically the gin and tonic. And you'd mentioned the Beach Plum Gin that you started making a little while back. That's actually like...
This is actually the third year we're releasing it. It's kind of cool because it is very much a vintage spirit. You know, the fruit changes from year to year. So we just actually released the third vintage like this week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's sort of like our twist on a slow gin. But we make it with beech plums, which are actually a native New York wild plum that are very close relatives of the slow and the damson, which are very traditional, you know, styles of gin or gin liqueur, whatever you want to call them.
And you use the base of it is actually
our dry gin.
The dry gin.
Yeah, and we soak we macerate the Long Island beech plums in our American dry gin in stainless steel for 7 months. We just add a little turbinado sugar. Unlike a lot of slow gins and damson gins are very, very sweet, you know, very cloying. Ours is much drier. It's much more like a gin liqueur than it is a liqueur, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a lot easier to, when you're using it in different applications for cocktails, it's a lot easier to add a little bit more sugar. You can never just take it out.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like when you're recording, Jack would agree with this, when you're recording, you can't take bass out.
Yeah.
But you can add bass to it.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, and that was, you know, one of the reasons why we kept it as dry as we did, because, you know, in this day and age, you figure big application for it's going to be cocktails. And as you said, you can always add sweetness, but you can't take it away.
And, you know, and experiment with the different sweeteners all along the way, too.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
I think when the Plymouth Slow Gin came out, it was kind of a perfect timing, you know? And I'm really glad that opened up that classic category for some newer style, like gins, like the Beach Plum Gin, like Damson Gins, things like that to come out, because you know, we're always looking for more, you know?
Sure.
And it's really great to have those flavors and cocktails. And man, it makes a hell of a, like, I actually like the Beach Plum Gin in a Tom Collins, man.
Oh yeah, that's one of my favorite ways to use it. Tom Collins, even a gimlet, you know, it's simple, but it lets the flavor of the spirit, you know, really come to the forefront.
And it's very aromatic too.
Oh, definitely. Beach Plum.
But clearly that's based on the Greenhook Dry Gin,
sure.
Which is actually like, so yours is a little, and I like this too about it. One of the things I like about a lot of gins, like Plymouth and Tanqueray and even Beefeater, like they don't subscribe to that 80 proof standard, you know, like when you're designing, can we say that? Yeah, you can say that, right? When you're designing a spirit, it's like, I feel like you gotta put it at the proof that, you know, you gotta put it where it's home.
Sure.
You know?
And gin is, you know, traditionally 94 proof. I mean, Beefeater, Tanqueray, those are your standard, the gold standard of gins, more or less, of London dry gins. They're at 94 proof, you know. And I think, like you were talking before about like that 1-7 ratio of gin to tonic in your drinks, think about what happens to that if it's an 80 proof gin. You know,
the gin
doesn't really get a chance to shine. You know, for my gin at 94 proof, it really allows the botanicals to shine, but it doesn't really drink with the heat or the astringency that you expect from a 94 proof gin. A lot of that has to do with actually how we distill it. We vacuum distill it, which allows it to be distilled at low temperatures, and that really prevents a lot of the aromatics and the botanicals from sort of getting stewed off with excessive heat. So it really drinks with obviously it's very aromatic, but it drinks without an astringency that you do expect from a 94 proof gin.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. I think, you know, I've been to your distillery a bunch of times.
Yeah.
Clearly. it's such a, when people get a chance to see it, it's like, it's a super small operation.
Oh, yeah. We've expanded since you've been there, because we're making room for our new product, our Old Tom Gin, which requires barrel aging, which requires a lot of space. But, yeah, absolutely. People come in there, and I think they're like,
whoa,
this is it.
it's amazing. And, like, especially, like, a vacuum still, like, you kind of think of it as, like, a really big, like, when I first heard of, like, vacuum distillation, I kind of thought of this, like, giant, like, weird, robotic, like, weird-looking steel.
Yeah.
Still. But, it's, like, it's super small batch, super small still, you
absolutely,
know,
yeah.
It's awesome, man. Keeping it really that way. And you had mentioned expanding.
Yeah. I mean,
got to throw some barrels in that place.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons we actually had to expand is because in Greenpoint, where we're located, all the filming is going on over there, big time filming, you know, HBO, VH1, and there's really not a lot of suitable distillery space or factory space left at affordable prices.
Is it all like it's all studio space?
It's all going to the filming industry. So
is it like Silver Cup kind of like moving down into?
Yeah, I mean, we got Cinema World next to us. There's a million of them around.
Wow,
there, but
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's tons of them. But, you know, I talked to my landlord because, like, as I said, our initial 5 years was coming up. And I said, I need another 10 years because moving a facility like that
with the
boiler and everything could cost a lot of money. And he sort of implied that if you're willing to take some more space, I'll give you a 10-year lease, you know. But it'll work out fine because, as I said, we need some space for lots of, you know, we got about 30, 40 barrels of gin in there now for our Old Tom Gin, which we're launching in September. So it fills up pretty quick. You know, you start buying bottles in 40-foot sea containers instead of 20-foot containers. it fills up faster than you might think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great, man. Well, that's a sign of success for me. To me, you know? Yeah, let's knock on that table. I think this is made out of real wood.
Yeah.
Well, this is.
Knock on your head.
Yeah, seriously. So yeah, you know, Old Tom Gin, man. Wow.
Yeah, we're
5 years
about
ago,
that.
You know?
Yep.
You're like, what? the hell is old Tom Gin, you know, or Geneva, you know? Now it's like, everywhere you look, it's like, there's, like, Bulls Geneva, there's Boomsma, which was one of the first ones I saw before I saw started seeing. Yeah. That was here before Bulls was, actually.
Booms was? I didn't realize that, okay.
Yeah. The Oud and Young.
Well, as we were talking earlier on, it is a broad category, gin, and if you taste like a, you know, Bulls barrel aged Geneva next to, you know, like one of these modern American dry gins side by side, and say these are both gins, you'd be like, "What are you out of your mind?" You know, it is a wide category, but it's cool when you actually, if you taste all styles of gin side by side, and you think about the progression and the time period that sort of evolution took place over. It's, you know, really like a 400-year period, you know, and a lot happened over the course of that 400-year period.
Happen, man. Yeah, totally. Yeah, totally, man. I mean, like, even looking at you know, American whiskey, it's like.
Sure.
Some of the earliest cocktail recipes that call for, you know, like American whiskey, it wasn't, they weren't necessarily aged, man.
Yeah.
Like,
or good, yeah.
Or good.
Absolutely.
For that matter. But yeah, Old Tom Gin, it's one of those categories, even in itself, that's kind of broad, you know?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the things about Old Tom Gin is that it's definitely, obviously, the missing link between the Dutch, the Hollands gins, and the modern gins. But nobody really knows if it was actually like a recognized style, if it was sort of just a slang term for the gins that were prevalent in England during that time period.
Yeah.
But the route we're taking is, you know, it was, they were really sort of in fashion before the invention of the column still. So the base would have been a pot distilled base. So the base, it would have had a lot more character to them than the modern dry gins. They would have been a little bit maltier, you know, a little bit more like, you know, towards the Dutch style, where it's going to appeal to a whiskey drinker just as much as a gin drinker, or probably even more so to that effect.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's kind of interesting to me that, like, when the Geneva kind of start hitting the market again, how, I mean, there's like, there's also this I had on the show a little while back people from Solbeso, and
from what?
Solbeso, it's a spirit that's made out of cacao.
Oh, okay.
And it's like, when you think about that, you think about you know, Dutch gin and the applications, like, as far as making it into a cocktail. You have to completely kind of like shut off your thoughts about like what your, like, is this a gin or is this a whiskey? It's like, you kind of have to like approach it with a whole new palate and like a whole new mindset. And like, just with that Solbeso you did as well, because it's like, it doesn't taste like chocolate, but every time you use it, people are like, oh, I want to do something I would do with like chocolate with this thing.
Yeah.
It's like, no, just
make an old fashioned.
Start out with making an old fashioned.
Yeah, Sazerac. When I drink the Bowles Barrel Age or even Allen's Chief Kawana stuff, I'd make a Sazerac with it or an old fashioned.
Nice.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good call. I haven't done that yet. Actually, I'm going to do that later. but yeah, I mean, like, well, especially this old Tom Gin we've been working on for a little while.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's barrel aged.
Yep. It's been aged for a full year, and we use bourbon casks, but we bleached them out pretty well and finished in an Oloroso sherry cask, so really excited for it.
Yeah, and it's super just ready for an old-fashioned, man.
Oh, absolutely. Martinez is old-fashioned. Mm-hmm. Pink gins, which I hope can get popular, you know?
Yeah.
Just some old Tom gin with some Angostura bitters.
You've been pushing the pink gin hard,
I have been, because it works really well at it, that's why.
Yeah. Nice. That's going to come out in the fall, right?
Yeah, September 15th is when we're looking to launch.
Nice.
Definitely. Yeah, we think that one of the things that I think people don't realize is that gin sales really go down in the cooler months, and it's, the reason is, it's not so much on premise. When I say on premise restaurants and bars, it's really what you lose is the casual sort of gin and tonic drinker who picks up a you know, a bottle of gin when it's 95 degrees out to make gin and tonics with at a barbecue. You lose that just on that first cold night in October, all the way through that first hot week in May. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's true.
So this, our Old Tom Gin, is definitely going to be a wintertime mover for us.
Yeah.
We hope so, at least.
Yeah. It's not, well, I mean, like, the only people I could think of that still, like, reach for the gin and tonic in the fall are, like, bartenders when they get off their shift.
I drink gin and tonic all year round.
Me too.
But I'm not normal, so.
Well, that's why we're friends.
Yeah.
Well, cool. We're at the end of the show, man.
Great. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, man. And
it was great talking to you, talking about gin.
Yeah, dude, I mean, that's what we do.
Yep, exactly.
So, what's the website?
Greenhookgin.com.
Greenhookgin.com. Yep. So everyone go check it out.
At Greenhookgin on Twitter.
All right. Yeah. Tweet at them. All right. Cool. Steven, thank you so much again for coming on the show. And can't wait to see you down down at Tails if
absolutely.
You're going to be there. All
I'll
right. Cool.
All right. Thank
cheers.
You.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.